SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
A good Tuesday. Race fans, Sirius 162, XM 207, Sports Zone 999, if you're listening to Sirius XM online, and at our website, stevebeck.com. And got a remarkable amount of news, including one really sad note. I hate when we get these, these after the fact passings. And I understand it's coming from Japan, but the word circulated yesterday about Blind Luck, it's probably some people listening that haven't even heard this. Unbelievable. Complications of foaling in April. And Blind Luck, I think, for a lot of us, you don't have to be of recent fan horse player vintage, but she's the kind of horse that made people into serious fans, and there's a lot. I saw a lot of Blind Luck, and I'm sure a lot of you did. Especially not that she was confined by any means to the West Coast, because she wasn't. And Jerry, put her on the plane a lot of times. She was a private purchase. She wasn't much really to look at, she was on the smaller side, and I can remember being at Churchill leading up to the Oaks. She had a few marks on her from skin disease as a 2-year-old, and she I don't want to say she was a ratty looking thing, but there really wasn't much. She sometimes you look at them and they're like, wow. She was not a wow. She was just tough as nails, and really, really fun to watch. Now, if Gary Young is listening, he doesn't have anything against Blind Luck, but of course, Blind Luck over Evening Jewel in a couple of different spots, but most notably in the Oaks, in just thrilling fashion, and champion. I vote for her every year when she's eligible now. She's been trying to get in the Hall of Fame for a number of years. And, I don't know the numbers. I don't know how close she's gotten per se, but daughter of Pollard's Vision, and out of a Best of Luck mare, and was all racehorse. 12 wins in 22 starts. 7 seconds. So first or second 19 times, a couple of other seconds, and then in the Lady's Secret at the end of her career, the only time she was off the board, when Garrett Gomez wrapped up on her and kind of eased her to the wire. But other than that, unbelievable. The great ones, the vanity, second to unrivaled Bell, of course, in the 2010. I can't even say the words ladies classic. It was so ridiculous. Distaff, the Alabama, the Delaware Oaks that year. Switch beater in the Hollywood Oaks. And you can't say that it was the synthetic because, you know, at that point, actually, the Hollywood track was sort of a mix of sand and, you know, there was silica and the Pro Ride, right? That was Pro Ride. And in a lot of ways, you know, by the time they were ready to take out the synthetic tracks, the Hollywood surface had actually become, you know, really quite good as a, you know, something to handicap off of. It was, you know, you didn't really think about it being synthetic, you know, the last couple of seasons at Hollywood. Anyway, the Kentucky Oaks win, the Las Virginas was a great one. She beat Evening Jewel a zop in there too. She was third in the Santa Anita Oaks. I may have been there. I can't remember this. I don't remember this. Crisp beat her, and all due respect, there were basically like four horses on the wire that day. But I don't remember being there. Gonna have to look that up. I can't remember. Interesting set of riders too that were most closely associated. You know, she ran for Jim Hatchett had her first at Calder. And she won off by 13 lengths. But, you know, then the private purchase and Mark D. Domenico and partners acquired her, and Jerry Hollendorfer fashioned this, to me, Hall of Fame worthy career. Joelle rode her first time out west at Del Mar. Then Tyler Bays had her for three starts, a first, a second, and a third in the debutante, the Oakleaf, and the juvenile fillies. She'd Be Wild and Beautician finished in front of her in the Breeders' Cup. She'd Be Wild, Catman, right? Catman? And Beautician, McPeak. But then she won the Hollywood Starlet to end the season with Raffi Bayerano, and Bayerano rode her six straight times. Then Joelle got back on her, Delaware Oaks and the Alabama, the Cotillion, second when Hobbs & Grace beat her, and then second in the Distaff with Joelle. And then Garrett Gomez rode her last five starts. Actually, Raffi stuck one in there too in the La Cañada. She was actually second in the Always a Princess beat her a couple of times. There's a name you don't think of that much. The horses that beat her, Zazu, Havre de Grace, Always a Princess, Unrivaled Belle, Switch, Crisp, She Be Wild, Miss Sueno in that Darley Deb. So I really was saddened when I saw the I don't know if it was a TDN alert or whatever, but I saw flashed up that Blind Luck had died. And best to all that loved her, including me. I really enjoyed that. I will not forget. I will not forget seeing her I must not have seen her as a 2-year-old. Or at least up close, I just remember seeing her in the paddock at Churchill, leading up to the Oaks, and thinking, "Wow, this is Blind Luck." All right, really tough. Since Japan is involved here in the conversation, I'll mention tomorrow morning. Take note, early risers, especially if you're on the West Coast, you're going to have to really early rise. there's the Stake Tomorrow that is going to serve as a Breeders' Cup Classic prep for Ushba, Tesoro, and Dermisotagaki. I'm sure we'll discuss this after the race with Dick Powell tomorrow, depending on what transpires here. But you know, two-thirds of the three-headed Godzilla that is that is coming over Forever Young training away. But, you know, this pair, tomorrow, I think 7 a.m., this is the Nippon TV High at Funabashi outside of Tokyo. All right, so set your DVR or whatever. All right. You'll be treated, and I'm sure this will be, I don't know if it will be as carefully monitored as City of Troy's workout. I'll let Dick talk about that too. That workout the other day was, you know, highly scrutinized, right? I think it was fine. I have no idea. You're either gonna be all in on him, or you're gonna be dead set against him. And it'll be discussed ad infinitum by the time we get to Del Mar. Right. Let me slip in the. I got to catch up on a few different results, and I don't want to get, you know, too far into the week without finishing the recapping from the weekend, because there were plenty of other, you know, we obviously, you know, yesterday with D-Wayne and with Kenny, catching the Derby and Cotillion recaps, Christophe Clement recapping, I think I got most of those stake wins in, right, that Christophe has fashioned over the last couple of months, plus Jack Sisterson and Kerry Bryan. But there's quite a few more. Yesterday, follow up on the visit with Anthony and at Finger Lakes, it was kind of what we anticipated. Stone Smuggler, Honest Mischief, George Abreu. This a New York Final Furlong Racing and Sunset Ridge Racing. Kai Barcoa, a little over even money, paid 410, and was pretty much, you know, was kind of a merry chase. Stone Smuggler and Mischief Lady, 1-2. Mischief Lady actually was third choice. And then when it came to the boys' race, Bostonian. Call it 4 to 5. Actually, 75 cents on the dollar, paid 350, and this was formful too. Soon to be King, second choice, chased him home. Wesley Ward and the Bernardini Gelding RT Racing Stable, Smart Choice Stable, and Denley Park Limited. Your owners, Denley Park, bred this Bernardini out of a Forest Wildcat mare, Falconess. But Bostonian Dylan Davis pressed into service, soon to be King second. And that horse, that King's Leap, I mean, not that the triple paid anything, but that King's Leap ran well to be third. And, you know, was kind of in the hunt all the way around, and couldn't get to the favorite and couldn't withstand the second choice, but 11-1. So those were the two-year-old stakes in the Leon Reed Rotney. And honestly, Rotney paid 410, and that was the most generous 410 you're ever going to see. Pompous Prince went off at 3-2 somehow. I thought that was crazy. Rotney, I don't know. I should have been 1-2. So if you got 410, nothing wrong with that. The homebred run happy 5-year-old. He's a horse, not a gelding out of a Spitestown mare, William Butler. bred and owns, and Mike Maker trained. So they looked like they had a nice, looked like they had a nice card. You had a crazy winner in the nightcap for those that were trying to close out a multi. There was a $50 winner in the nightcap. Hector Garza sent out a Bob LaPenta bred 5-year-old. He is bona fide. One of the great lines. And oh, brother, where art thou? He's bona fide. He's got prospects. Just a now. Wait a minute. I'm the damn Pattis Familia. If you have not seen, oh brother, where art thou? Highly recommended. All right. There's your movie recommendation for the day. We're going to talk to Eric Hamelbeck in about 5 minutes or so, and got quite a bit to cover with Eric. You may have seen the SCOTUS headlines yesterday, and a lot of administrative pure administrative I dotting and T crossing. Eric will explain it and where things stand, but the basic send up is this thing is this is absolutely being decided in the Supreme Court, period. And there seem to be enough smoke signals to indicate that this will be decided by June of 2025, by the end of the Supreme Court term. So we'll let Eric parse that out. We also are going to talk about the contamination issue that seemingly there's real movement on the HISA front after posturing initially, including Dr. Scalise's declaration that there's no such thing as environmental contamination, which was a kind of a silly posture to take. Can use the George Duarte situation, which also involves Bonnie Lucas. Bonnie Lucas's case is not resolved, curiously, because the basis for lifting the suspension on Duarte involves the hot walker that on consecutive days handled horses that had meth positives, Duarte and Bonnie Lucas. There's some other secondary issues that are kind of, I'm guessing, holding up resolution on Bonnie Lucas's case, which we probably won't handle today, but needs to be brought out at some point. So Eric's going to join us in just a little bit, and I think I want to bring up with him as well, the what transpired with the Parks turf and Heise's involvement there, and a couple of public perception, kind of a misinformation campaign that that seems to be, out there, trying to effectively smear the horsemen. I don't know how else to put it. So we'll do all of that with Eric shortly. There was a story that caught my eye. It started with a tweet, and then I followed it to Bloodhorse. That you may or may not have seen, which the future of televised racing in Ireland in jeopardy. Did you see this by chance? It's a very, it's kind of an eyebrow-raising story. The Gambling Regulation Bill in the Irish, they don't have parliament. I don't think it's a parliament. It's a, not sure. Well, it says lower in the legislative body in Ireland. It's calling for a ban on gambling advertising between 5:30 a.m. and 9 p.m. And Racing TV and Sky Sports have said if they can't show advertising for the bookmakers, then they can't broadcast. It is a very strange scenario. I mean, and certainly, I mean, having been there in, you know, December last year, I mean, the Ireland's racing crazy. So I was sort of rubbing my eyes reading it. So I'll have to find out more. We may have to call on some of our Irish correspondents, which there are actually a few. But that story was a little unsettling. Let me slip in a couple more results before we reach for Eric. And LoSal wrapped up the brief 2-week meet, and of course, I don't know how far anybody has gotten into looking at the fields for Saturday. Saturday everywhere: Churchill, Aqueduct, Santa Anita. But they did draw, you know, they drew the Crown, California Crown card, and it's good. It's very, really good. And in fact, Jeff Franklin and I will do the Eddie D down the hill and the California Crown on Thursday as the races. You're going to get those. You might get them as soon as tonight, I would venture to guess. But the Eddie D is terrific down the hill. And Christophe Clement, did he mention that he entered Big Invasion in the Eddie D? If he did, I missed it. I can't hear everything, but Big Invasion, and he actually drew really well. He drew outside, and managed to land Flavian Pratt, which won't hurt his prospects. Good field for the Eddie D, but the Crown itself. A quick rundown: Newgate for Baffert. Mandela has got Subsanador, who of course came to Monmouth and next the Philip Island. You've got National Treasure after the misfire in the Whitney. He's going to try. He's ticketed for the Dirt Mile, but is going the mile in the eighth here. Katona for Doug O'Neill, third off the layoff, and Muth, who's been kind of we've been kind of waiting for Muth to materialize. Had rumored for the 3-year-old assignments out of the shared belief, so he got an extra week instead of going to Philadelphia. Senior Buscador, of course, stretching back out after the tune-up in the Pat O'Brien, where essentially you're just getting his sea legs after the World Cup. And Sadler's got Indispensable, the runner-up to Muth in the shared belief, kind of a developing late-season 3-year-old. So that's your California Crown, and beyond that, the City of Hope. City of Hope. We'll see if wonder if Jay's going up to present. I know he presented the trophy, I think last year or the year before. Nice field for that. The John Henry came up very good as well, and I think you got the Unzip Me, right? The Girls Down the Hill. It very nice card Saturday to inaugurate the the California Crown concept. Closing out Los Al, that's what I was actually sort of alluding to. Dark in the Dark Mirage show card. Here's a 3-year-old filly for Baffert. Came back from a little bit of a layoff and has now won back-to-back show card, won the Tranquility Lake, and then wins this Dark Mirage. Just kind of seems okay, running 80 buyers. And let me slip in those three Remington stakes that we talked about with Dale Day, right? You had Do You Want to Dance as the 2-1 favorite, win the Bob Berry with Goncalves for Scott Young and Terry Westheimer. You had Tap the Dot win the Red Earth for Asmussen Equine and Martin Riley, this Amoro Tap 6-year-old gelding. Was actually third choice. Paid a nice $9. Did Tap the Dot. And in the Turf Sprint, Dark Afternoon, Austin Gustafson for Blackhawk. Jim Rogers, homebred. A black bear gelding. So that was that group. And at Gulfstream, too, let me slip in those, as I called them, the remnants of the, at one time, one of the great summer events in racing, the Summit of Speed. And they had to take the Bob Bumfrey off the turf. But they, you don't lose much on the Tapita side. And Reef Runner for the Lieblongs, David Fox. This is a Lieblong homebred, a big beast. Manny Vasquez aboard, went off at 6-5, wins the Bob Humphrey, and of course, so many racing office denizens who learned the trade either alongside or from the late Bob Humphrey. Gustavo Delgado had a nice looking maiden winner, Sarcastic Joke. You saw that. That was in between the stakes. And then later, the Aventura Crazy Frazee for Delgado, George Delgado, as opposed to Gustavo, and Lee Farms. This is a Fipke bred Blame Colt. Crazy Frazee won well. And there were like three horses that were basically co-favorites in here. Lightly raced 2-year-olds. And then in the Ginger Punch. I'll save the Princess Rooney for last. In the Ginger Punch, Fox sent out Royal Light Racing's first dude filly, Charlie's Wish. Second choice, paid $8.40. Also Manny Vasquez, and came from well back to win the Ginger Punch. And in the Princess Rooney, which is still a Grade 3, one time a Grade 1, Soul of an Angel. Snappy Joseph for C2 and Agave, the Atreides mare, who's, I tell you, fashioned herself a pretty nice career. That's her fifth win in 40 starts. She made 13 starts last year, and she's made 9 so far this year. Soul of an Angel, and coming out of the personal ensign. So a very effective turn back, and I imagine, although she's not, I don't think she's, being by Atreides, I don't know if she's Breeders' Cup. They may have to pay, not that group would be unwilling to pay. We'll have to find out about that. All right, so that was some of the other weekend results, and I've got a little bit more that we'll get to as the morning unfolds. Right now, I think I've got Eric. Do I not?
I am a man of constant sorrow.
That a boy. Look at you. Look at you. Well done.
Yes. No, how are you, Steve? Everything's good here.
All right.
Rainy day in Lexington, but we certainly need it.
No, exactly. Pretty much everywhere, I think that's fair. I mean, when it comes to racing, we're like, oh, it's beautiful, it's beautiful, it's beautiful. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, gosh, the turf courses are dry as a bone. No good. Well, thought of you immediately yesterday as the reports emerged about, of all justices, yeah, Justice Aito getting involved in, you know, what is obviously going to be a case that the SCOTUS is going to have to decide, given the district, you know, the differences in the various, you know, the various circuits. Explain what transpired yesterday, Eric, and what it means in terms of timing and executions.
Sure. Thank you, Steve. I appreciate, you know, the opportunity to come on and try to explain it a bit. Gets a little weeded, and the wording is awkward for most of us horsemen trying to speak the legalese, but hopefully I can, you know, explain it a bit. I'm going to go back one step in that after the July decision, the opinion from the Fifth Court declaring unconstitutionality of HISA, there was recently a, I'll say, petition to stay or to stop the relief that would be granted to the plaintiffs, and that relief or that award, if you might say, would come from the lower court in the Fifth Circuit. So that's just how, again, you've said it several times the last few weeks, the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted. So there was a request by the FTC and HISA to not allow that to go down to the lower court, not to give relief until the Supreme Court made a decision. That request was denied very quickly, actually within 24 hours. So the next step, again, procedural, certainly anticipated and not a surprise, and would have done on both sides, they went to HISA and then subsequently the FTC. The attorneys then put in a petition or a request for the Supreme Court to offer up a stay, or again, to stop any relief to be granted from the Fifth Circuit's decision. And as you said, Justice Alito, he oversees the Fifth Circuit. And this is, again, something I've learned. Each of the circuits has a judge, and they are responsible for that district. So in the Fifth Circuit, seeing the petition, seeing the request, what he did was, as of yesterday, he said, okay, let's give an administrative stay on the relief until I can gather all the information. And then also he ordered our attorney group, along with those who have intervened in our case, the state of Texas and then Gulf Coast Racing, you have to respond, or we have to respond as to why we don't think this is a good idea. We don't think a stay is necessary. That has to be turned in by next Monday, so the 30th. So again, you know, it's a lot of words on paper. You know, T.D. Thornton, I thought, did a good job trying to explain it. You know, again, I think that, you know, when you read these sorts of things, it's going to be shaped as however your opinion already is formed. But at the end of the day, this is a procedural scenario, which, while some people want to continue to say it's taking too long, this is exactly what we are fighting for, due process in the proper form, you know, within the litigation itself. And again, the enforcement of how rules are adjudicated is very important to horsemen. And that's why, again, we continue to say that, you know, the courts are going to decide this case, and it may take a while. We understand that, but that's due process. That's the legal way to do it in the United States, not throwing hammers down, not, you know, taking away occupational licenses without any proof or without any adjudication. You know, this is the way it goes, and we're willing to be patient and sit back and wait to see what happens. Now, granted, I think all sides at this point wanted it to get to the Supreme Court so we could have a final decision. You know, we parsed out the opinion from July. you know, again, I think paraphrasing Alan Foreman, he said it was the beginning of the end. You know, I don't see how that really equates to what the opinion read. You know, I see it as a pillar of the act written by Congress and passed by Congress as law. You know, when a big pillar of a bill is declared unconstitutional, it affects the entirety of the bill. So, again, we know that this was going to get to the Supreme Court, and I think, you know, unlike everybody else, the sooner the better. Again, you know, you've given me the platform that many others have not, to constantly say win or lose in the courts is a win for the horsemen, in that we know it's constitutional or we know it isn't. We just want it to be the right thing for horsemen. We want it to be the right thing for the industry. And certainly, as you've allowed me to say many times over, the National HVPA has been pursuing uniform rules and regulations based on veterinary science for longer than I've been sitting in this seat. Go back all the way to 2012, when Dr. Tobin and Kent Sterling, you know, wrote the world rules for equine drug testing and therapeutic medication regulation, you know, literally in print for several years, trying to bring about uniformity, describing what is based around science, whether it be therapeutic or contamination. So yeah, we're going to keep fighting for it. Obviously, somebody who had to have their head in the sand, if they think that everything is uniform now, you know, the National HVPA is not about patchwork rules. I mean, I would go on the record and say that I believe the rules were much more uniform than we got credit for when the bill was passed. But at the end of the day, we are standing firm to try to bring about uniformity in a constitutional fashion. And that's why we've continued to try to float along with the Racehorse Health and Safety Act. It may not be the perfect bill, but at least it's probably, you know, the closest thing that we've got to uniformity that is 100% constitutional, at least at this point, because, again, the way our Constitution is based, you have to have state involvement in order to be constitutional. So we'll continue to roll along with that and see how the courts decide, and hopefully we're there to help bring about uniformity wherever the courts land on this issue.
Eric Hamelbeck with us in the wake of yesterday's latest, not even a development, it's just a procedural aftermath.
Yes.
Of the last several weeks. I want to expand on the rule uniformity topic, Eric, for a second, because the critics who seemingly can't discuss any of this rationally and coolly. Everything has to be a smear and an indictment of what they screed as the horsemen wanting to to go back to to the way things were. That's a laughable posture, considering how much effort had been going into model rules and a lot of the advancement. Alan Foreman in particular, we had these discussions for years, and the RMTC visits with Dr. Waterman originally, and there had been so much progress over a 10 to 15 year period. No one is going to say that there haven't been benefits from HISA's presence. But explain, Eric, from your perspective and the horseman's perspective, why that's an unfair characterization, that that having HISA and HIWU struck down as unconstitutional. Why you want that, and what would be the, you know, the next process, to gain industry-wide, cooperation for whatever would replace it.
Right. Well, the first thing I do want to say, and I know I've said this before, just remember, in the years leading up to the point where we are, horsemen have never been in charge, right? We're not regulators. There's no one that has adapted more and been, amiable to change to new rules than the horsemen, because at the end of the day, we weren't the ones in charge. Now, unlike, everything that has developed, we were always very instrumental in the model rules process and had a voice at the table at the RNTC, and things didn't always go our way, absolutely. And we understand that. But at least people heard what we've had to say. And I think, and this is going to jump way ahead and I'll jump back, I think some of that same thing is now happening under the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act. They've heard us. they may not have wanted to, but there are things that are changing. But with regard to, and I'm going to point to the RHSA again, the Racehorse Health and Safety Act. Again, we feel as if the first thing that needs to be done is to create a constitutional form for uniformity. And Alan is right that I've heard him say that's been tried before, but it never has been tried on a federal level, right? They've tried to do some things historically, and again, this is before I was in this seat, so before 2015, that they tried to do a state compact. And I think the Mid-Atlantic, which again, I always try to wave the flag, there are six HBPA affiliates in the Mid-Atlantic. It is not just a THA initiative. This is two horsemen's groups working together for the betterment of a region that has a significant crossover, and they were able to develop, a uniformity, or at least very close to 100% uniform. But when you have a federal compact, and we've looked at different models, it does require the state to pass a law signing themselves into the contract. And, of course, everybody looks at that as, well, there's your opt-in, opt-out, and that doesn't create uniformity. And I'm not going to disagree with that statement, but you have to go one step further and say that does create constitutionality and legality. It's the way for the federal government to have a footprint but not be in control. Having the adjudications done through the commissions, done through the states, having the governance of the laboratories all done through the commissions, I think would be the way to push forward in the future. But again, under the RHSA, we now develop what is called the RHSO, the Racehorse Health and Safety Organization, that mimics to some extent what the authority does now under HISA. Now, I don't usually describe it that way because I'm more familiar with the model rules process, and those folks who are out there who understand the model rules process, if you think of the RHSO, the Racehorse Health and Safety Organization, it is, in my mind, set up much like the ultimate model rules committee. So you have stakeholder meetings, you have input, and once you have that grouping together in a discussion, you can make changes, make additions or removals of rules and regulations under the process, and it becomes uniform across the board. So again, that's the idea that I think we need to get to in a constitutional fashion. But the main thing is the two biggest problems with HISA, cost and adjudication, they go back to a constitutional fashion within the state. Right? Because one of the things that's not even been adjudicated in courts that most people don't realize, that one of the biggest things about one of the problems under the Horse Racing Integrity Safety Act is that there is no federal money. And there are many people, including some major racetrack owners, who have said the biggest problem is the unconstitutional aspect of HISA not getting any federal funding. And I've said before, and I may have said here with you, Steve, if we had gone into this process early on and the federal government was pledging XYZ millions of dollars to help run this program, we might have a different conversation. But at the end of the day, I think you see where the funding has become a problem, how it's, you know, burdening folks, and also I don't see the sustainability of the Horse Racing Integrity Safety Authority under the budget they have, because I don't think that they are getting the monies that they are even budgeting. And so, you know, what's going to happen when that does fall apart, if it falls apart because of lack of funding? Where are we now? So, again, I feel as if, you know, we need to get to this point of uniformity. That's how I think we can get there. I understand it was tried on the state level, but it's never been tried on the federal level, and that's what we're trying to do. You know, and back to one last point, you know, I saw a post on Twitter, and I've become less active on Twitter for a lot of reasons, but, you know, someone said on Twitter, again, very uneducated, that, you know, we are advocating for the failures that were at the UK laboratory. I mean, how could that even be conceived, right? You know, first off, that the leadership at that laboratory wasn't around, you know, pre-HISA. So, you know, we are not advocating for problems. We are not advocating, certainly, for cheaters as those who continue to label that. I would point back and just ask the question, what cheaters have been caught? You know, what in this current system and regime is any different, other than the problems with adjudication, than what we had under the ARCI model rules? What has been uncovered? What has been, you know, adjudicated to the point of we have dismissed cheaters? You know, what we've done is, and this could be a good lead to the next topic, what we've done is uncover the problems with zero tolerance and the lack of respect for contamination that's in the environment.
Well, and I was going to, as it happens, I was going to ask you a little bit about you know, your impressions of what went on with the Kentucky lab. Go on with the contamination issue a little bit, Eric, because it's come up repeatedly, and Alan's been invaluable, you know, with each of the, you know, particularly with the human, you know, the drugs of abuse, and also the metformin topic as well. But when it comes to particularly with these meth positives, and the Bonnie Lucas / George Duarte situation on back-to-back days with the same hot walker. Anybody that was dubious about transfer of trace amounts, you would think that this might convince them that. Gosh, maybe there's something to that. And you know, Duarte's suspension was lifted, and I know, you know, how relieved he is after sure. trying to fight it. Bonnie Lucas' case is still out there to be resolved, and apparently, Haiwu. She's run afoul of another aspect of Haiwu construct because they sent out sample. They tested the horse on their own, and that apparently offended the sensibilities of Haiwu. You're not supposed to test on your own horse, which is quite something, without their permission.
Without their permission. Yeah, that is literally a regulation. And I've seen that come up on multiple occasions now, that a test that was not authorized to help mitigate the circumstance, you can't use it because they didn't authorize it. Now, you tell me what a double standard that is when, again, we're in a system now where you are guilty until you yourself prove yourself innocent. Again, unconstitutional, but that's the way the law is written. But yet you can't offer up any by any means necessary mitigating circumstances unless it's approved by the people who are adjudicating. I mean, just listen to how that sounds, right? You know, we've caught you. We think you've done wrong, and now we're going to give you permission as to what you can do or not do to prove your innocence. Now, you can hang all the signs you want to, and I'm in that boat now. I'm passing out flyers. We're trying to hang signs. Don't urinate in stalls. Wear exam gloves. You know, things that aren't even necessarily protocols for HIWU technicians as far as wearing gloves. And, you know, nobody is asking the HIWU technicians to, in the laboratories that I'm aware of, to write down what medications you're on before you go to work, you know, but yet they're asking trainers as employers to get all their employees on whoever's on medication, write them down and put them on a piece of paper, and that may help you in a mitigating circumstance. Well, then I, by God, want to see all the technicians at HIWU. I want to see their information. You know, where is it? Maybe I'm wrong and it does exist, and I'm happy if it does, but you know that gets a bit infuriating. But you know the drumbeat of, you know, contamination does not exist, and you mentioned it earlier, Dr. Mary Scalay, you know, and she's gone to great efforts to say that. You know, all knowing that in 2010, when she was the equine medical director of the state of Kentucky, she literally had a morphine positive that she herself dismissed with a concentration that was associated with environmental contamination. Morphine. So, you know, that's out there. That's real. And, you know, we understand that contamination is out there. And I truly believe that, you know, there are, through advances in science, there are high school football kids that may test positive for something that's wrong because of the way contamination is. And all we're asking, and I would say because, you know, our push, which really initiated strongly after the Rusty Arnold positive, but it's been a drumbeat for years, our push to the FTC for a rulemaking request, again, trying to go about things the right way, it's based on the fact that we understand things are in the environment, and all we're asking is for a level floor, not a ceiling, a level floor for levels. You know, if the level at the floor is 500 picograms or 1 nanogram, many of these substances have science behind what could be a legal screening limit. Now, I think Ron Moquette has said, which I believe to be true, you know, there's been fluctuation in the threshold, or better suited to say, screening limit for methamphetamine, even under the regime of HISA. I don't think that it's fair that they have not gone retroactively in their adjudication process, but I can't do anything about that. That's what they're doing. Similar with metformin. But there needs to be a floor that everyone can abide by and that we understand, based on science, it doesn't have an effect on the horse. So our push for no effect threshold is going to continue. It was continuing underneath the ARCI, and it all kind of got pushed out the window based on the HIWU mainly being a presence of a drug is and can be a violation. Now, I'm not saying that they don't have certain thresholds for, obviously, therapeutic medications. Obviously, they do. when you look at the fact that we have water systems that are testing metformin, especially in Midwest racetracks, it's in the water system in picogram levels, you know, it's going to happen. We get a lot of pushback saying, oh, well, you would have more positives if it was truly in the water. Well, we're not testing every horse. You want to spend the money to start testing every horse and every barn, then I think we'll find more. Not that we want to, but that to me is not an argument that we would find more if it was truly an environmental contamination. Because we are not following something that is based outside the realm of science. And in fact, in this instance, with irrelevant concentrations, which is the proper way to say it in the science, we say no effect thresholds, but irrelevant concentrations are widely used in the human world. You know, we've used this argument for years. Certain concentrations of methamphetamine can be found in a commercial pilot, and they still fly a plane legally. You know those stories in the 80s when cocaine was everywhere, and you could test positive from touching dollar bills. You know, it's out there. And now that science is advanced to the point that it is, and it's only going to continue to advance, we just need to be able to understand and respect irrelevant concentration, call it the noise that it is, it doesn't affect the performance, and let's move on. And part of that, Steve, and maybe the biggest part for me, is that it doesn't get publicized, right? You know, we had a conversation with one of the FTC commissioners about a month ago and explained to him that the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, does not recognize anything in human drinking water at a picogram level. You know, we were going through positives at a Midwest racetrack of Sotinol, a medication that helps in heart arrhythmia in humans. And we found Sotinol very prevalent in the water source. And here we find the EPA, you know, again, for human consumption, doesn't recognize it in a picogram level. So you don't say anything. And that's part of the problem. The Pimentals, you know, a lot of these folks, certainly Jorge Duarte, you know, I mean, when you have these levels that are insignificant and you publicize them, again, you look at what happens in the court of public opinion, you're guilty anyway. I mean, you're guilty anyway. People have lost horses because of the problems, even though they may have been retracted. And that's not fair to the industry, and it's certainly not fair to the trainer.
No, and you know, considering that a lot of the Hay Oats and Water Alliance people, you know, considering that they were, you know, clamoring on a going basis to be like the rest of the world. Well, the rest of the world utilizes those common sense screening levels.
Correct. You know, I always look at, you and I have we've certainly beat this drum. You know, you look at Lasix, right? The one thing that probably initiated all of this odd infatuation to remove Lasix from horse racing. You know, furosemide has a screening limit in Europe, right? You can have furosemide in the horse's system, because again, I know from years at Adena with horses in training with Jim Bollinger, I always laughed and said he uses more Lasix than Chad Brown. You know, and again, because we use it on race day, but they have a screening limit for it. So if it's below that screening limit in plasma or urine, nothing gets said. You know, to me, that's the goal, because, you know, I'm not necessarily advocating for, you know, let's say it this way. The rebuttable presumption, you know, offering up mitigating circumstances is important. But if there's nothing to offer up because the concentration was irrelevant, then no one needs to know. I mean, again, if it doesn't have an effect, and I think that there were laboratories pre-Issa-Haiwu that understood that. There are laboratory directors that understand what is the noise, and it's such a micro level that it doesn't need to be brought to the attention of the Racing Commission. You know, I kind of look still at metformin. You know, you talked about the international world. You know, there seems to be a lot of weight on what WADA does, the World Anti-Doping Association, which, again, is not equine-related. They don't even acknowledge metformin. And here we are. We're ruining people's lives over metformin, micro levels of metformin. Now, again, I've learned from Dr. Tobin. I'm certainly not a veterinarian. I'm not a pharmacologist. You know, the abundance of amount that you have to take for metformin if you're a human, and it's excreted in the same amount in order to have an effect for an equine, for a performance athlete equine, let's just say 1,000 pounds, is tremendous. So why are we, you know, adjudicating at the picogram level of metformin when in some instances we certainly have mitigating circumstances, whether the trainer slash groom slash whomever, you know, and I do continue to hear that there's proof that it's being used. And I don't have any proof, honestly, one way or the other. Obviously, it's in the horse's system. But at micro levels, there's no physiological way that that is having an effect on the horse. And certainly most human doctors that I talk to, obviously that I know, don't feel as if metformin would even have an effect on the horse, certainly not a performance-enhancing effect. But, again, we circle back to the same focus, and that's really trying to understand irrelevant concentrations, whether it's HISA going forward and HIWU going forward, or it's we get back to the model rules process. I probably am not going to jump off this train because I want to make sure, you know, this is the one thing we need to really focus on, because I think it certainly helps the industry, doesn't give us those black eyes that you and I have talked about for years now.
Yeah, 100%, because a certain percentage of observers, you know, any called positive, whether it's, you know, something that is a legitimate, you know, therapeutic med overage, or whether it's something that doesn't belong in a horse, they're just conflated immediately. It's been so unnecessary. I mean, for, you know, for years this has gone on. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not a new development by any means. I've got one other arena too that occurs to me that, you know, in terms of, you know, kind of venturing into areas that, I mean, HISA wasn't necessarily, wasn't created necessarily with things like the turf course at parks in mind. But they, you know, they took an active role. And then you have, you know, the complete disaster that occurred on Saturday. Just curious. I mean, is that an area that, you know, that any authority, whatever form or shape it takes, isn't that a jurisdictional or a, you know, racing venue slash jurisdictional
problem.
Topic?
Yeah, well, first let me obviously be clear that Parks is a THA racetrack, but also I think you know me well enough, Steve, you know, we can't fix all the problems. You know, that's why I have a big problem with, you know, the comparison of fatality rates from one year to the other. This world operates on a bell curve. And as a longtime farm manager, going 3 years without a dystocia and then having five in 1 year, it's dangerous to compare or to use a negative to compare for a positive. But in this instance, you know, when you look at the jurisdictional operation, the control, or even authority, I personally don't think that that HISA would have the authority to shut down the races. I don't believe that. Now, whatever magic they could pull to all of a sudden flip a switch and turn off export signals, maybe they have that right, but I don't think they logistically have that option. But what they are in this instance in the safety regulations, which is, again, one of the aspects of HISA that we were happy to see put in there, because we proclaimed coming out of the Santa Anita tragedies that someone needed to help guide all racetracks with, you know, provisions and guidance and certainly measurements that could help. So, you know, I'm not going to condemn anybody that said, you know, the track is fine. But, you know, what I see is that the horsemen and the racetrack management group should get together. And from what I understand, at least I understand that the president of the Pennsylvania THA was advocating not to race on the racetrack. But again, I'm not intimately involved with the situation, but I think that's a horseman and racetrack management decision. Then they need to understand that the optics that we're in now, you know, I certainly applauded the report that that Dr. Palmer put out. You know, I mean, here's a report that, you know, reading between the lines, you know, this was saying, hey, we've got to do better at managing the racetrack. You know, it's not the horseman. It's not doping. It's not running the horse too many times or running the horse too early. Sometimes there are problems with the racetrack. And I think in this instance, the authority and HISA, you know, they have the opportunity to give recommendations. But, you know, if they, quote unquote, approved, I mean, again, I go back to what Dr. McElroy said a few months ago. You don't know. I mean, you can't. I think it's dangerous to stamp approval and say, oh, this racetrack's fine, nothing's going to happen. You don't know that. You don't know that. And so from a physical standpoint, and again, I'm not there. I wasn't there. I haven't even been there. But just seeing some of the pictures, I would have concerns and want somebody with boots on the ground to make a decision. But I think it should have been a decision that's a culmination between the horseman's representative and racetrack management. You know, and then ultimately, if racetrack management pushes horsemen to do something they don't want to do, then it comes back to horsemen's responsibility and safety and what's in the best interest of equine health and welfare, as well as the jockeys. So, you know, I think I applaud them for taking it off. I don't know, again, not being there, whether it should have ever run on there. I can speculate that the problems they were having seemed to lean towards maybe they shouldn't have tried. But at the end of the day, I don't want to blame HISA and any sort of recommendation, but I also would caution anyone at HISA for stamping approval of anything because, you know, again, you and I have talked about it for years, Steve. Those sorts of things are going to happen no matter what safety initiatives we put in place. But by God, we certainly don't want to open it up to a situation where we know something is not safe.
Yeah, and you know they also, you know, they also took an active role last year with Churchill and with Saratoga, and you know there's certainly a hand in glove element when it comes to, you know, the equine safety side and surface.
Sure.
Obviously. So,
sure.
You know, sure. there is a role. I mean, but I thought this situation, you know, kind of demonstrated the, you know, the pitfalls and the you know, the practical dangers of essentially pretending that that there's a panacea to all of these industry issues.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah, that there isn't an answer for everything. And again, especially when you're looking at racetrack services, I've always tried to explain to people they're very much like a plant, very much environmental caused, or I should say affected. You know, that you can't place one set of rules on every racetrack, sometimes not even on the same racetrack in different seasons. So you can't just look to one entity and say, they said it was fine, so we're good to go. I mean, it just should not work like that for anybody. But I do think, and again, I'm speaking pre-HISA and HIWU, you know, you look at the efforts of the track superintendents, you look at the efforts of from UK and Dr. McPeterson and, you know, some of the things that have spawned from his work. You know, we already had a lot of that in place, and you know, right down to safety rails. You know, things were moving in the right direction from that standpoint, obviously. You know, but again, being private property, it's hard to tell somebody what to do and have a forcible stick to make them do that. And I'm referring to, you know, you pick a topic, hello, Racetrack A, you've got to do this, and then prove to them how you're going to force them to do it. That's a difficult ask. That's where I think it comes back to horsemen have to be involved in those decisions.
Well, and that's been an area in general where, you know, you've tried to wave that flag that, you know, horsemanship is going to be the deciding factor as opposed to, you know, regulatory horsemanship by regulation.
Yeah. We cannot regulate horsemanship. At the end of the day, you know, if we get to the point where we're over-regulating, that horsemanship diminishes, which I think there are some instances that's occurring, that then we're in trouble. You know, I firmly believe that. And again, growing up and being a horseman at heart from the standpoint of that's all I've ever done, you know, a lot of people just see me sitting in this seat. I don't think they realize what I've done for a living all these years. I take what's in the best interest of the horse, and I was lucky to work for a guy like Frank Stronach who allowed us to do that. So, you know, I put a lot of merit on horsemanship, and it's one of the reasons, Steve, and I think you'll agree with me, why I'm so frustrated that we weren't involved in the process. And I don't mean Eric, right? I mean we, as in having boots on the ground people. Like, the Horsemen's Advisory Group should have never been an afterthought. That should have been on the forefront before regulations were ever even submitted to the FTC. And again, I'm going to keep coming back to those points that, you know, that's the kind of thing that should have been done. Again, I know Ms. Lazarus was thrown in at the last minute, but the ramifications of the negatives, and I'm not saying they're all negative, but the negative effects that we've had under HIS and HIWU, many of them could have been thwarted if we had had that input on the front end. You know, I got a nasty text the other day, Steve, you'll love this, you know, and it was one of the most backhanded comments that backhanded compliments that I think that I've gotten, you know, just basically reaming me up one side and down the other and how I'm ruining everything in horse racing. But then the text ended with, you know, if you'd have been sitting at the table, HISA wouldn't have all these problems to begin with. And so I started laughing and I said, well, should I respond thank you or F you? I'm not sure.
So that is funny.
Yeah, but, you know, again, I just want people to, again, to appreciate horsemen and understand that we've been nothing but compliant to the rules and regulations. And I know this is a drumbeat that Ron Moquette, who is a true boots on the ground guy, a wonderful trainer, wonderful horseman. You know, he's got statistics of how we're losing trainers, and you know, horsemanship cannot be taken out of the game through regulations. It just isn't going to be good for the horse.
Eric Hamelbeck, National HBPA, and Eric, thank you for the review of where things stand on the SCOTUS side, and we hadn't had an in-depth conversation in a while, so perfect.
Thank you, Steve.
Perfect juncture. Thank you.
Talk to you soon, brother.
There it is, Eric Hamelbeck, everybody, National HBPA, and kind of incorporating, I don't know, half a dozen of the topics that intersect. And, you know, actually, I should have brought it up with Eric still on the line, but as a farm manager, I saw where I think... Let me confirm this because I don't want to congratulate him with if I've got it wrong. No, I got it right. Ned Toffee at Spendthrift named the Farm Manager of the Year, which is a really kind of a under the radar kind of an inside baseball. Award the Kentucky Thoroughbred Farm Managers Club, the Ted Bates Farm Manager of the Year. Congratulations to Ned. We're going to spin right from our visit with Eric into a visit with Jose D'Angelo. You heard him the day before, or maybe 2 days before, Howard Wolowitz won the Franklin Simpson, and because I have a system in place, Jose, whereby whenever Al Gold wins a Grade One, he gets to come on the show. So we spoke to Al first last week.
Hello, Steve, you hear me?
I got you. I was explaining that I had Al Gold last week because he had won two Grade Ones, and he always comes on after he wins a Grade One. So that's why I didn't call you, but I'm glad that I didn't, because on Saturday you brought back Ben Tornato in the Gallant Bob, and Jose, terrific performance, and it feels like he's a horse now that you've decided he's going to sprint. It feels like he's a horse that's going to impact the sprint division. Congratulations.
Thank you, Steve. Yes, because he let us by ourselves in his house. So, we did just thank God. I'm so happy. It was a good month. You know, I have big hopes in Howard winning the Kentucky Downs, the practice season, and Ben Tornado. I was pretty very confident on him, on spring him. I know since he lost the third leg of the Florida Stallion Series, that he cannot go long. You know, he was very well prepped to run this race, and he lost. You know, he's big horse, strong, huge, but he moves too quickly. So that made me think. I spoke with Angel, his owner, before the race, before the third leg of the Florida Stallion Series, that I don't think that he can go long. When we went to Saudi, I was pretty sure. I said to him, hey, listen to me. You're going to see your horse in front probably until the half of the stretch. It's long stretch. I think this 1 furlong more is an extra for him. I think his perfect distance can be in between 6 and 7 furlongs. You know, that's why I'm very confident on him for Saturday. He ran a huge race on Charlestown, and he came back pretty good on the Gallant Bob.
I mentioned when we were handicapping on Friday, Jose, the fact that the Hilton, he was coming out of Charlestown, that's a 2-turn 7 furlongs, and it's kind of funny, the Saudi Derby mile is one turn, that configuration. And it's obvious that that's what, you know, that really suits him. You know, you're winning stakes with IRAD, which doesn't hurt. And, of course, Ned Allard's horse, Sunny Breeze, ran absolutely huge. They were almost inseparable at the wire. What was central to this and what motivated me to call, a 103 buyer, or 101. And, you know, that, you know, breaking into the triple-digit buyer level kind of indicates, you know, that he's moving in the right direction here at the end of the three-year-old season. He's a valiant minister that Tanma had bred, but he commanded a nice price. He was $170,000 last year at OBS.
Yes, you know, like the funny story, like my owner bought him to Pink Hook, and they sell the horse, but they he don't pass some tests, and they pass the horse to him. That's why I have his name Ben Tornado. I used to welcome back in Italian. So, you know, he's nice horse, and I'm pretty sure that he's going to be at the top level at the, like you said, on the division of Springer here in USA.
Jose, tell me about Leon King, Leon King Stable.
Yes, they are from Venezuela. They started here with, you know, they started with the claiming horses and later buying better horses. Things look a little bit, but, you know, like the goal of everybody here is try to go to the Derby or the big races, because sometimes you buy a horse to run the Derby and the horse is last, you know. But the most important, it has good horses. And they are enjoying now having Ben Tornado and so nice horses. So, you know, that's what
they are
doing right now.
Talking about Ben Tornado, who won the Gallant Bob on Saturday, Jose D'Angelo with us. We talked to Jose at Kentucky Downs before the Franklin Simpson. And before we talk about Howard Wolowitz, and I also want to bring up, you had that horse run a nice race at Presque Isle too on Friday night. Well, KC Chief, we'll talk about that in a second. What's the plan for Ben Tornado? Do you get a chance with him? He is Breeders' Cup nominated. What are the thoughts?
Yes. We ran a huge race on Friday. He looked by Presque Isle, and we drive to from Presque Isle to Paris race this night. So, you know, Ben Tornado, our plan now is to go to a Breeders' Cup. I'm pretty sure that he can improve a little bit more. If you see the workout chart, you can see, like, I worked strong him for Charleston race. For this race, just easy workout, because I know, like, probably the Gallant Bob is just, you know, one step to the main goal. And I always think, like, when you train horses, is the most hard, you know, the hardest part of training horses is, like, keep a horse at the top of his level for 1 year or, you know, for some time. So that's why, like, I train him a little easy to try to train properly him for the Breeders' Cup. So I am very confident on him, like he can improve more.
Well, I've been saying all summer and into the fall that the sprint division has been, you know, kind of growing and getting more and more interesting. And here's a very good three-year-old, and I'll have to check with Ned Allard and see what he's going to do with Sunny Breeze as well. He's not nominated. He's a Cajun Breeze. But the two of them were terrific in the Gallant Bob on Saturday. Let's go back 2 weeks and get your view of Howard Wolowitz, because this was a terrific performance. And IRAD rode him, Jose, like he knew he was the winner the whole trip.
Yes, you know, like And you know that I really like the horse for the race before because we have the other, like you say, over there. So I trust me to Irad, you know, very, you know, confident on the horse. Like, I really like the horse for this race. He trained very well. His workout was beautiful at Saratoga before leave to Kentucky Downs. This is the kind of horse that the beast, to me, I know it's, you know, it's not easy, but to me, he's going to like the up and downs, the hills at Kentucky Downs, because that makes like more grounds. I know we are going to a Breeders' Cup and it's 5 furlongs, but to me, he's much better in a little more grounds, you know, like 5.5, 6, going to help him, because he's the kind of horse, like, he's not fast from the gate. He just develops his speed, okay? You have to let him make his own move, and when you are seeing, he's gonna kick back. And if you see, if you watch the race, was like Ira said, Ira did. He let the horse run by himself, 3, 5, 4, and when he asked it, the horse get the another gear. That he did when he worked, and I tried to repeat on the race and work it.
Well, wind's clear, wind's easy, and as you mentioned, the, you know, the distance limitation a little bit at Del Mar, and not going to be easy to tackle Cogburn, but Howard Wolowitz and Al Gold with a terrific win. Let me get some impressions about Friday night. Casey Chief, basically, along with Mike Trombetta, Forever Super, it was the two of them. The good race.
Yes, it was a good race. I'm very proud of him. He improved so much. Well, you know, from a starter to a stage, it's big difference on the field, and the horse was on the level.
What do we know about? Tell us a little bit. This is a 5-year-old, and really haven't noticed him before. I mean, you've only had him for 3 starts, but you know, he had won the 2 since he came your way.
Yes, you know, like, I get the horse very good shape, and I start training him. I really like him, but I noticed, like, he's a, you know, like, we have him something special in front, because he started to getting better, and when he won first time out for me, you know what, I like to see the numbers. You know, I think, like, we are in a horse sport, like the numbers probably don't tell too much, because it's, you know, it's, they are animals. You know, one day can be one thing and another day can change completely. But I, you know, I like the numbers. And if you see, if you watch this race, he was faster at the second fraction. And usually when a horse do that, he at Goldstream, on an other track, it's hard to keep the lead and win the race. When you make fast fraction, when you do faster at the second fraction, you know, sometimes you get tired. So he won, and he gets another gear getting on the last furlong. So he ran next race against Clyde Doubleby, like, he was almost in the field here in Florida on the Tapira, and he beat the horse. So he went to a digital self. David Berenson and Leon King both in. And I say, hey, probably with this horse we can do better, because he surprised me on the Alouan. And when a horse do that, I think if I train, you know, if I train, I change a little things to train a little harder to go to the stakes, he can be there. And that everything working perfect. You know, that's sad that we don't win, but he proved that he belongs to the estate.
Well, he had won, and he had won 2 straight for Julia, for Julie Stormfelt, and
yes.
then he went through the digital sale in August, right? And he went through the Fasig Tipton digital sale, $75,000 for a ready-made horse.
Yes. And, you know, he has the starters open, so he has, you know, a lot of races coming up. Just we have to do the right decisions, and he's going to be on the top.
Very nice. Well, I mean, he had won four straight coming in, two for you, two for Julie, and KC Chief, five-year-old noble bird gelding, and he certainly, you know, certainly has paid for himself out of the out of the $75,000. The digital, this is why the digital sale format has become so popular, because you can put yourself, you know, in the game. You know, it literally in 3 days. You know,
yes, and you don't have to move the horse. You know, it's less stress for the horse.
Exactly. Really nice.
Yes.
Well, there's it's been a good fall, Jose, obviously, and you know, continued success. I wanted to find out more about Ben Ternato out of the Gallant Bob, and we, you know, we were there for Howard Wolowitz as well, and things are going good for this last third of the year. It's already your best year in, as a trainer.
Yes, yes, Steve. I'm very happy about that. You know, we are getting better horses and showing up our skills like a team, like trainer here. You know, at the end of the day, you need the support of the owners, horses, your teammates, you know, because it's not easy to move the horses for all the country and keep winning. So I'm very grateful with the life and God, and I would like to say thank you to everybody for the help, because if without them, it's not possible to do that. And, you know, now this year, hopefully we are going to Breeders' Cup, and it can be, you know, for sure it's my best year, and hopefully better things coming.
Jose D'Angelo, everybody, and Ben Tornado, your Gallant Bob winner, and arcing toward the Breeders' Cup, as certainly good three-year-olds have impacted the Breeders' Cup sprint, and Howard Wolowitz as well. Jose, continued success. We'll talk soon.
Thank you, Steve. Bye. Thank you again.
Not at all. Jose D'Angelo, everybody, and this feels like a pretty good timing. Interesting. What an interesting campaign. And he got, you know, even though he got beat in the Hilton at Charlestown, 99 buyer, which had been a career best, and there was certainly no disgrace finishing third. He was beaten six lengths in Saudi, but there no disgrace getting, you know, beat that distance by Forever Young and Book 'Em Dano, right? And you might say, well, somebody had to be third. Okay, yeah, that's true. Beaten six. But, you know, here he is. He's made eight starts. He's never been worse than third. He was third in that, the In Reality. At the beginning there, Jose was talking about the Florida Stallion, you know, the Florida Sire Series, and he had won the Fager and the Affirmed, but those were 6 and 7 furlongs, and then he had to go the mile and a 16th, and he actually didn't get the lead either. He never saw the lead. And it feels like he's really maturing into a serious horse. And again, I'll tell you, Ned Allard's horse, Sunny Breeze, ran just huge. Too good to lose, as they say. And 18-1. Hour and a half in, 90 minutes. Horse health today. Yeah. I had actually reached out to Dr. Alday about a dog issue. I wanted some free veterinary advice for a friend's dog, but no sooner did I do that, and I said to him, it's been very quiet on the horse health front, no sooner did I say that than bone bruising came up yesterday, right, with Christoph, and we haven't talked about that. Was it with Christoph or was it with Wayne Lucas? I can't remember now. But I thought, you know what? We haven't talked about that probably since Smarty where Fleet Alex, I think, had had some bone bruising. That right? Anyway, that's our topic. Horse Health Today, brought to you by Lubricant and Reborn. Andy Serling at the top of the hour. Second half at the races. Sirius XM.